ごちそうさまです。Well, good evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line from back in the Washington, D.C. area, Dr. Joseph Douglas, who has written Red Cocaine and another book which we carry in stock right now called Betrayed, the story of the men we abandoned in the Second World War and in Korea and Vietnam. Right tonight we're going to be talking about a treatise that Dr. Douglas has written recently on the 9/11 report. Now, Dr. Douglas has worked in government for many years, a great deal of contact with various levels of the intelligence agencies, and he certainly is well aware of what goes on in Washington, D.C. He's writing now as a civilian, looking at the 9/11 Commission report, and although he says there's a good deal of information there, he is very, very concerned about just some of the lack of the failure of the 9/11 Commission to address the real issue, and that is, why did this happen? Why wasn't anybody fired? If 3,000 people were killed, you can't blame it on the process. You have to blame it on people. Why wasn't anybody held responsible for what happened? And with that as the background, Dr. Joe Douglas, thanks so much for being with us tonight.
It's always a pleasure to be with you, Dr. Stan.
Well, why don't you sort of tell our listeners your thoughts on the 9/11 Commission report, which, of course, is widely circulated. Anybody can buy it for $12. The first report, which came out from the Joint Select Committee, had a great deal of good information in it, I thought, that wasn't censored out by the government because they didn't want us to know, or maybe they didn't want Osama bin Laden to know, for whatever reason they censored that, and yet that report still had a great deal of information, but it was about $65, and without an index, it was put together specifically, so it would be extremely difficult to utilize in understanding what happened. But the 9/11 Commission report is very, very economical. But tell us what you think about it.
Well, I got very interested in it when it came out, and decided to get a copy and read it, Dr. Stan, and as I read it, and read it through once, and then another time, it made me very disturbed. And very disturbed because, they're making all this noise about having a new national intelligence directorate, and of reorganizing the intelligence community, and of changing the way in which the terrorism committee works for the CIA. And what struck me as I read through this report several times was there was absolutely nothing in it that had anything to do with organizational problems. The problem that was clearly present there was not one of an intelligence nature. There was plenty of information. There was plenty of warning. One cannot possibly say that the principles, the war principles, did not have warning. The question was, they didn't do anything. Matter of fact, they deliberately seemed to do nothing.
And did you have that feeling as you read about this that they were putting directives out all the time, but they didn't seem to be reaching where they were supposed to go? They were informing the FAA, but the FAA didn't seem to get the warnings, or if they did, they didn't do anything with them, and the warnings weren't getting down to the local offices of the FBI across the country. Most of them had no idea what that was known in Washington, D.C., and you have to ask, why?
Oh, the FAA was an excellent example. They have a section where they look a little bit at the warning, and what is very clear is nobody did anything right. They didn't follow protocols, they didn't follow procedures.
Hold that
thought
right there.
Everything they did was wrong.
Hold that thought right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening, Dr. Joe Douglas, and we're talking about the 911 Commission report, and Dr. Douglas's impression, and he's pointing out that the FAA seemed to have failed to follow procedures. They did everything wrong, and yet nobody's responsible. It's all the process. Pick the story up there, please.
That's absolutely true, Dr. Stan. You know, they had information in the system 30 minutes, minimum of 30 minutes before the first plane crashed. And nothing was done. Nobody called anybody that had the authority to do to make decisions. The president was not notified, evidently, until after a plane had crashed, and then the information that he gave him misrepresented the situation. You know, when you think about it, 30 minutes is an awful long time. That is traditionally the time that we always calculated it would take about to launch a missile from the Soviet Union and have it strike the United States. And here you have warning of an attack being present in our system underway for 30 minutes, and nobody does a thing. And not only that, after basically castigating the civilians and the military people by just enumerating the facts, they then say in the commission's reports that they saw no reason to hold anybody accountable for what had happened, in effect, as though they did nothing wrong. Well, of course, nobody wants to necessarily blame the operators, but somebody certainly did something wrong, as anybody who's been in the military would recognize. If the operators did not respond to protocols, they didn't respond to training, then who is responsible for the training, for the protocols, to making sure they are looking, you know, after the farm, so to say? But, of course, that was totally neglected. The whole report is designed, as might have been expected, I guess, to hold nobody accountable.
But of course,
find nobody at blame whatsoever.
But I think that was the purpose behind this. Certainly, Portugas was formerly with the CIA, was in charge of the House Intelligence Committee of the House of Representatives Intelligence Committee. Portugas, who I believe has always represented the CIA, even when he was in Congress, now has come back to be the head of the CIA. He's bringing four other people out of Congress to work for him in the CIA in key positions, and you wonder who Congress really represents.
that's a wonderful case. You know, the Portugal thing is very interesting. There's one or two excellent paragraphs in the commission report. The only people they took to task was Congress. And they described congressional oversight of the intelligence apparatus with one word, dysfunctional.
In fact, but that was Portugas, the man who headed the Intelligence Committee of Congress, and now they brought him in to take over this Central Intelligence Agency.
That's right. They take the head of one of the dysfunctional congressional committees, put him up, and the other dysfunctional committee approves him.
Hold that thought for just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening is Dr. Joe Douglas, and Dr. Douglas was saying that in the 911 Commission report, the only person or group they took to task was the Congress and, of course, their intelligence oversight, because Congress has oversight over the intelligence organizations. Now, the man who headed that committee, the House Intelligence Oversight Committee, was Portugas. That man, who, of course, the commission, 911 commission, was really pointing out directly, although I don't know that they named him, has now been brought in to head the CIA as the new the director of the CIA, and he's bringing four people from Congress to work with him, in the Central Intelligence Agency. Almost looks like we've got the fox guarding the hen house again.
It certainly does, and it's really pathetic. Of course, we recognized early that there would be no accountability. It was just not clear that they would do such a poor job, deliberately poor. You know, you could not do something like this unless it was intended that way, because there's just too many oversights. They didn't follow up any of the logical leads. They didn't ask any tough questions. They let everybody get away with who were very guilty of trying to suppress any effort by the top principals to have to address the issue as a group, where nobody, you know, to get away from the one-on-one situation where a whole group considers it, so the discussion has to be relatively honest. And of course, that one person that orchestrated that was the National Security Advisor, Condoleezza Rice. And if anybody really should have been fired after this thing right away, it was her. But of course, she wasn't, because she was really following instructions. And I think that's the key thing. It was all a farce.
And I think what was really so significant about the 911 commission was that they had a number of interviews, probably many hundreds, if not up to 1,000 interviews. I don't know the number, but they were all held secretly. One of my friends, a frequent guest on our programs, Peter Lance, was there, and he was interviewed by a gentleman who had been instrumental in making all the mistakes that led up to 911. And then, of course, there was no television taken. There was no recording. There was no transcriptionist there. They just took some notes. They sat there for several hours listening to his testimony. And then, of course, they thanked him very much, and that was declared secret. It will not be released for 30 years. Now, if there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing all of the other testimonies that they took? Why can't the American people at least see that under the Freedom of Information? Oh, no. We can't let the American people see it, because they might tell Osama bin Laden, and after all, it's in the name of national security. And the thing is, Dr. Douglas, my concern is that it is all national security, but are we protecting or keeping the information from our enemies or from the American people? Or maybe they consider the American people the enemy. They cannot be allowed to know the truth about what happened on 911, and they have sealed all of that testimony and all of the information that they did not put out in their report for a period of 30 years. Furthermore, the administration went through and censored the report before it was ever released. So how can we determine what really happened when the report was censored by the committee, was censored by the administration, and if there's nothing to conceal, why are they concealing it?
Actually, I think you can go a step further on that, Dr. Stan, because not only did they keep all of that testimony secret, but they then staged, at every few months, public hearings. Now, they have all those hearings identified in terms of who had gave the testimony in the commission report at the back, and when you look through at the names that they strolled out here before the television lights so the public would really understand that they were doing their job, you find that almost to a man, every single one of them is basically a politician or an appointed official. There's only one person that I could see on the list that came up, and he only because of a book he had written, that was not there to put on the good image, to make sure that nothing bad was said about the prior administration or the current administration.
And you're speaking now of Richard Clark.
Yes, and he was the only person, of course, that also came up and actually said, you know, he failed, he was really sorry for it. And the only person that really appeared to have any inward sympathy for what had happened to those 3,000 people and the families.
Well, I think you could see his frustration in his testimony. You could certainly feel his frustration if you read his book, and when he kept trying to let them know there was going to be an attack on the United States, and he kept trying to tell the members of the Bush administration there was going to be an attack. The Clinton administration was ready to go to war after the coal. It had taken just an attack on the coal. But they needed a plan, and of course the plan was drawn up by December of the year 2000. But of course, the Clinton administration said, "Well, we really shouldn't go, you know, take America into war, you know, with the Taliban and with the Al Qaeda at this time. So we'll turn over the reins of power to the new administration and let them take care of it. But here's the plan." And that plan was completed in December of the year 2000. That was the plan that was enacted, of course, almost a year later in October of 2001. They had the plan. The Bush administration had the plan. It was just a matter of getting it worked up. And they did exactly in October of 2001 what, of course, Richard Clark had planned on doing in December of 2000. But the average American doesn't understand that. This was planned ahead of time. We were going to war with Al-Qaeda. We simply needed an excuse to go to war.
That's true. And, you know, one of the things I think it's important to point out to your listeners, Dr. Stan, I was very disturbed when I read this report, and in trying to understand better what was happening, I took pen to a pencil, or pen to paper, if you will, and really started writing out the thoughts I had on this thing and what the problems were, because there was a lot of information in that report, a lot of conclusions you could draw from what was said and what was not said, and even to the fact that there was no question that there was tremendous warning, and if there was anybody that was really guilty and that should have been hung up on a clothesline, it was every one of the war principals led by the President and the National Security Advisor themselves. So I put this all down as clearly as I could with all the page references and everything else, and put it on the Internet where it's widely available as an article on financialsense.com, and anybody is welcome to go there, read it for free, pass it on to other people, and let other people comment on it and get their reaction to it.
And it's a very good article, Joe. I've really enjoyed reading it. That's at financialsense.com, and it's Dr. Douglas's article. What's the title?
The title is The 9/11 Commission Report and Appraisal.
Right, and it's well worthwhile reading. Well, let's go over some of the items that you felt were really so glaringly insufficient.
Well, I think the one thing that becomes very apparent was the minute the new administration took over, there was absolutely no question that there was a threat, that it was a lethal threat, that the United States was a target, and that the terrorists were going to hit us. That was made very clear in about three briefings identified in the report that the President received, several that Vice President Cheney was reported to. Certainly, Don Rumsfeld received several. Steve Hadley at the NSC and Condoleezza Rice were briefed. Everybody that was important to have this information had it. And you mentioned Clark. The first thing he did was give a memo to Condoleezza Rice that said, "This issue is so important, we have to have a meeting of the principals to discuss it as a group."
And the principals, of course, would be the Secretary of State and the Secretary of I suppose Condoleezza Rice and Secretary of Defense, and would that include the President? What are there about ten people would be the principals?
Yeah, and it's the heads of the departments and selected other people. As a matter of fact, one of the people who used to attend the principals' meetings before the new administration came in was Dick Clark himself.
Right,
and presumably at the same time, the day after Clark gave this memo to her, she withdrew him from being able to attend the principals' meetings. So she cut off his direct access to the principals as a bureaucratic maneuver right at the beginning, and he was the one person with responsibility, the one person who knew the facts and the politics of the administration. Down cold, he really understood how the government worked, and he was the person that was really deathly sorry about what was happening. And, you know, he was just obsessed with it. You know, here we have this tremendous threat. We knew it was going to happen. It was coming. As the head of the CIA said in that summer, all the lights were blinking red, and nobody did anything.
And of course,
his hands were tied by Condoleezza Rice.
And, of course, it would have been such a simple thing to have put the marshals onto the planes. Instead of arming the pilots, they put out a directive 2 months before 9-1-1 that no pilot could carry a weapon because some pilots were carrying weapons and were authorized to by their air carriers. So they put this out knowing full well an attack is coming. They did not reinforce the doors. They actually decreased the security to get on the planes, which made it easier for people with weapons to get on the planes. They did not inform the pilots. They did not inform the stewardesses. They didn't inform anybody that they knew an attack was coming. And you have to ask yourself, why? Why weren't helicopters on alert, helicopter gunships in all of our major cities? That would have certainly, they knew Washington, D.C. and New York were targets, and that was in the presidential daily briefing of August 6th of 2001. So why didn't the president do the logical things? Why didn't he begin stationing, the National Guard in our airports at that time? And that would have perhaps discouraged the hijackers from attacking. If you wanted to discourage the hijackers from attacking, that is the haunting thought that I have. Was this, of course, everything done not to do what was right? Did they need an excuse to take us, first of all, into a war with Afghanistan, and then into a war with Iraq, and then perhaps very soon into a war with Iran and Syria and with other countries? September 11th changed the world forever. But the question is, why was nobody punished for dereliction of duty? Why were the people who did everything wrong promoted? And, of course, I think that is the haunting question. When we get back, we'll address that and other questions with our special guest this evening, Dr. Joe Douglas. You can get this fascinating article on the Internet at financialsense.com. That's financialsense.com. And I think that, I hope you will be as infuriated as I am after you finish reading it. Well, Dr. Douglas, why don't you pick up the story from there?
We talked about, how Richard Clark had a hard time getting the people to get them to understand the nature of this threat. There's 2 points about that. Number one, they understood the nature of the threat. Matter of fact, they were looking for it, we think now, as a reason that would justify them going to war, particularly against Iraq. And that was not addressed in the commission report, although it was clear that they should have, because the whole surfacing of Iraq as a country to invade came up at the first NSC meeting, and that was in Paul O'Neill's excellent book, was written by Ron Susskind. That's another eye-opening one for people to read.
That's called The Price of Loyalty, and
yes.
I certainly recommend it. Go ahead.
Yeah. Now, Clark was not the only person. We're not talking about a single maverick who was concerned. Not only was he concerned, the head of the CIA recognized that we were in war, and he was really trying to do everything, not everything. He was as upset, I think, really, as Clark was. Not only that, but the head of the CIA counterterrorist unit was also extremely concerned, the same as Clark was, in trying to raise an alarm. In addition to those three very senior people, there were 2 people within the counterterrorist support group at the NSC who wanted to quit, or were considering quitting, in June, before the attack, to go public with what they knew, to warn people, and not just that there was an attack, but that nothing was being done, because they knew that you had to get people activated to prevent this attack. And not only that, but as the commission said, that there were many officials toward the end of June in the summer, when the whole threat process was just blinking red, as George Tenet said, were ready to resign, who tried to figure out what they could do. They were desperate to do something, but their hands were tied because nobody would pay any attention to it.
Well, of course, there were several FBI agents who went to David Shippers, who was had been the counsel for the House Impeachment Committee. There were several FBI people, or at least who went to a friend of mine named Garth Nicholson and told him that Pentagon was going to be attacked on the 11th of September. They knew the date. And there were, of course, but none of these men could come forward. They would lose everything. They would be attacked and vilified and perhaps even indicted for releasing government secrets. So nobody can really come forward, and the only way they could come forward was to testify before Congress, and you could be sure if they testified it would be in secret.
Absolutely. And so you have tremendous amounts of warning. There's no question that the United States was at risk. The other aspect about the 9/11 Commission report that's very interesting is they threw a lot of material in, and whether they realized when they were doing it or whoever did it recognized it was as damning as it was and they wouldn't have a chance to get a close review of it. Whether they did this inadvertently or purposely is hard to say. But they provided about two pages on what had happened during the Millennium Crisis. Now, that was a transition from the year 1999 to 2000. And there were a lot of threats of increased terrorist activity at that time. And they looked at the things that went on just almost automatically because the fact that there was a threat was out in the public domain. You couldn't keep a secret of that thing anymore because it was out there. As a result of that, you had all of the intelligence community people sharing information. So you can't blame 9/11 on the fact that information wasn't shared.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, our guest this evening, Dr. Joe Douglas, who is the author of the book Betrayed, which you certainly should read, but it's on a different subject. But his article on the 9/11 Commission Report is available on financialsense.com. We recommend it to you. And Dr. Douglas was simply saying that the 9/11 Commission commented that the time of the Millennium Threat, as just in the latter part of 1999, as we approached the year 2000, why all of the intelligence agencies were talking to one another. They knew there was a threat at that time, although certainly nobody was talking much about a terrorist threat from Al-Qaeda. They were talking about, oh, those nasty right-wing Christians or the Christian militia. That's where the real threat is. And you read some of the material that came out at that time by Janet Reno. She was really accusing the Christians of trying to overthrow the country or something ridiculous. But they were not talking to the public about the Islamic terrorist threat, although they knew the Islamic terrorist threat was very real. Dr. Douglas is pointing out that the intelligence agencies were talking to one another at that time. So this idea that, well, it was just they couldn't talk to one another, they'd built walls in September of 2001, that really wasn't true, was it?
No, that's all a diversion. And that's all to justify the fact that, well, it was the system that was broken, not the people. And they demonstrated that in this item on the Millennium Crisis by giving two examples, excellent examples. One was the FBI, that's normally very secretive about things, was passing information on terrorists to all the law enforcement agencies and other intelligence agencies during this period of time. The same thing, they said that reports from the CIA were going into law enforcement and police offices around across the United States that they'd never seen before and wouldn't see, during 9/11 either. But they were available in the Millennium Crisis. And so you had all sorts of actions being taken place. You had various defense measures being taken by people even within the aviation sector. Most interesting is that's when they had a customs gal over in Washington State that caught somebody coming over from Canada with a trunk load of explosives that was headed to Los Angeles Airport. And they try to pass this off as, well, just a chance meeting that she was decided to inspect him. Well, that may have been a chance meeting, but it also could have been just because of the heightened tensions and the talking among the officials and in the newspapers and all the play that it got, that she was a little bit more careful and she was more suspicious. Because you don't need the government that much to protect us. All you need is alert, normal people that are down lower level at the bureaucracies and the police departments, the fire departments, even the little old ladies with umbrellas in airports. I mean, everybody can be alert when they know there's a problem.
It's like the airline hostess who saw John Reed, the mad shoe bomber, trying to alight the fuse going into the sole of his shoes. Of course, John Reed didn't know that it couldn't possibly go off because it was C4 explosive, and he had to have blasting caps, but at least he saw that, and when he kept trying the second or third time to right the fuse, why, of course, they tackled him. But it was the people who did that, certainly not the CIA or intelligence agencies.
That's true. And in the Millennium Crisis, again, there's about two paragraphs filled with all the different actions the different agencies were taking place during this crisis. And then they close it off by saying that there's absolutely nothing comparable in 911, notwithstanding the fact that the warnings were far more numerous, far more severe, to the point where you had many senior officials who were desperate to get somebody to do something. But nobody would do nothing. Nobody would do anything.
Did you almost feel that there was like somebody didn't want to do anything? Certainly David Shippers wasn't allowed to contact anybody in government. He knew John Ashcroft, and John Ashcroft wouldn't talk to him. And he knew the leaders of the House of Representatives because he'd worked with them, and none of the key people would talk to him about the impending attack on America he was trying to tell him about.
That is the key message that comes out, like it or not, in the 911 Commission report. Whether it was deliberate or inadvertent, I don't know. I think that they probably had to really get that thing out in a hurry, and that it just came out because of the facts that they did present and of what they didn't say about things that the questions should have been asked. But the one thing that comes out is nobody could be told all the things that our top leaders were being told and not wonder themselves what was happening, not take up discussions on defensive measures, and instead just worry about, well, should we have a policy of regime change, or is there another way in Afghanistan, or maybe we can do the Taliban and help them, get them to take on the Al-Qaeda, or perhaps maybe a Pakistani intelligence, aside the fact that they worked with the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
And I think, of course, everybody should know that the war plan was on the president's desk on that morning, the plan to go to war with Afghanistan. On that very morning when, of course, the attack came, and then we had justification for going to war and carrying out the attack plan. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening, Dr. Joe Douglas. We're talking about his essay, which is up on financialsense.com on the 911 Commission. So pick up the story from there, Dr. Douglas.
Let's go back. You know, this 30-minute thing is very critical. That surprised me that they had that identified in terms of somebody that had called in, not only in terms of the knowing that the planes were not in communication, but also an actual cell phone call in from one of the passengers on one of the planes, which gave them even more warning time than would have been anticipated. So they knew what was happening, and it wasn't just a case of not being in contact. They knew what was happening over 30 minutes before the plane crashed. Now, if that had happened back in the 50s or 60s and maybe even into the 70s, when there was some serious concern about defense and national security, I don't think there's a single person that was involved at the FAA or the National Military Command Centers or the Intelligence Command Centers. And you know these people are all talking to people on open lines when something like this happens. Not one of them would not have been fired. That would have been totally intolerable because the flight time of a missile in the event of an attack was about 32 to 33 minutes. You couldn't afford to have important information like that sitting idle and not one person following protocol or training in which they know who to call. They got the phones on their desk. The whole idea is to get everybody up and in communication within a couple of minutes on something like that, if not less. It didn't happen. They never were able to contact the president then, who was the one person that would have had to give them the authority to shoot down the planes, which they could have done. There was plenty of time to get the planes to do that. But it didn't happen. You know, why on earth, you know, and why on earth can that not happen? I mean, can that take place? And then you have statements, written statements in the commission where they say, well, this is a direct quote, "We do not believe that the true picture of that morning reflects discredit on the operational personnel at the needs," that's the military component, "or the FAA facilities." Well, my goodness, you know, if it's not them, then who else? I mean, you don't just drop something like that. You know, there's absolutely no interest whatsoever in learning what happened or why or in trying to fix the system so that it didn't happen again. And there's only one way you can explain that, and that's because the people at the top wanted it to happen.
Hold that thought. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening is Dr. Joe Douglas, and he's pointing out that as you read the 911 Commission report, why you get that they keep saying nobody's responsible, nobody in the FAA is responsible, nobody in the government is responsible. It just sort of happened, and Dr. Douglas's remark was that, you know, how do you explain that the fact that nobody would be held responsible? Certainly, as he pointed out again, you know, during the Cold War, why it would take about 31 to 32 minutes for a missile launch from Russia to strike the United States. And there, of course, was a plan so that if there was a question of a missile attack, why the president would immediately be notified and he would, of course, give the order to counterattack. But that morning, there was 30 minutes from the time that a flight 11 disappeared, and of course, then to the time when, of course, it hit the World Trade Center. And even after that, why it didn't seem that anybody could notify the president, that the president didn't really do much of anything. When he was notified, you remember he sat there reading about the story about the goat to the children for an additional 6 or 7 minutes. And then, of course, he got up and left, and then he got on the Air Force One. It would appear that nobody wanted to address the situation that morning. Now, the idea that, of course, we weren't prepared for this sort of thing, people have to understand we were constantly having war games involving the possibility of internal attacks and planes being hijacked and crashed into our buildings. The NORAD, of course, the military was well aware of this threat and were practicing for it, but on the morning of 9/11, nothing happened. So pick up the story from there.
There's a lot of information that supports all of these things and explains a lot of the things. I did not use any of that information in general in the paper I did, because I thought that the report, if you read it carefully, spoke volumes by itself and didn't need any support. An intelligent person could not read through that report and think about it and without reaching exactly the type of conclusions that we've drawn. There are a couple of instances where I did bring in some additional information because it was in the public domain, and it should have been subject to the same type of interest by the Commission as it has been to many of us. And one of them that really sort of inadvertently, or not inadvertently, you know, without understanding what was about to happen, really sort of provided us perhaps a key to unlocking this puzzle, and that was the former Secretary of Treasury, Paul O'Neill, in the book Price of Loyalty. Now, he kept careful notes. He's a very objective guy with a tremendously good reputation for seeking the truth in situations and looking for substance, not spin. And he made two comments, two reports there that were very interesting. One, the first NSC meeting he attended, which was on January 30th after the inauguration, 2001, and he said he couldn't understand it. They were bringing up the issue of Saddam Hussein and the need to preemptively attack Iraq. And he said this went on, and it didn't end there. They had another meeting of the NSC 3 days later, and again, not only was the subject pursued, but this time they had detailed maps of Iraq. They had the oil fields laid out. They had oil explorations and where the major undeveloped fields were. They had lists of all the people that would be interested in sharing the oil and helping to develop it. The question was not should they, the question was only when and how did they engineer it.
How were they going to get the American people to go along with a preemptive strike, as I remember? And of course, really, this was so interesting because this was Donald Rumsfeld, this was Dick Cheney, this was Paul Wolfowitz, and they were leading this. And of course, here Paul O'Neill is sitting there thinking they're going to be talking about something really of significance, and they're talking about how are we going to get the American people to go along with a war with Iraq. And this is in January and in February of 2001, 7 to 8 months before the 9/11 attack. And that is a little scary.
It is. And what O'Neill went on to say then is he remarked that in the discussion, at the February meeting, that the Secretary of Defense, Don Rumsfeld, said that, well, you just can't attack a country. We need a justification. We need an incident. And he was musing on the idea, well, what would happen if a U.S. plane was shot down? Would that give us the justification? Somehow, he said, we needed an incident that would justify an attack. And one can't help wondering, well, okay, where did it go from there? Is this why all of a sudden everybody clammed up and nobody cared about any of the warnings of the attack that we were receiving daily, almost hourly when it got into the summer of 2001? Did they want it to happen so that they could then use this war, this attack, as an excuse to go to war against Iraq?
Well, there are a lot of unanswered questions. One of them, of course, we know that morning they evacuated the White House, but they didn't evacuate the Pentagon. And you have to ask yourself, why didn't they evacuate the Pentagon? Starting about, 9:03, 9:05, somewhere there, because Norman Mineta's testimony, he's called to go to the White House. He gets there about 9:15, and, of course, they're evacuating the White House. But the plane didn't strike the Pentagon until somewhere after 9:30, 9:40. So why didn't they evacuate the Pentagon? And why wasn't the Secretary of Defense, going to the White House to be in the war room? Why was he sitting at his desk quietly? And by that time, of course, the first plane had hit the World Trade Center, the second plane had hit the World Trade Center, and they knew the third plane was on its way into the Pentagon, and Donald Rumsfeld just sits quietly at his desk in the Pentagon, never has told us what he was doing, but he certainly wasn't taking charge at that time. That is what's so frightening.
No, you're absolutely right. Matter of fact, someplace in there, and I think it was before the first, he was in a meeting, getting some intelligence briefings, I think, and it was during the meeting that he was informed that the first plane had hit the World Trade Center. Did he stop the meeting? No. No, he had the briefings continue. That's tantamount to what Bush was doing down in Florida when he continues his kindergarten listening test there or something and doesn't get up and leave to take charge of the situation. At the Pentagon, you had the same thing. All of us that have been in the government at one point in time that have had the privilege to sit in on those intelligence meetings that are held early in the morning, it's not something that can't wait until the next day or the next week as far as that matter is concerned. I mean, it's sort of routine. If it was an emergency, it would be a special type of thing and not what he was sitting in, according to the descriptions. Did he get up to really find out what was happening? No. And like you say, here's the guy that takes the orders from the president and is responsible for the defense of the nation. And I cannot believe that the NSC was sitting there without any communication from somebody, because they were tied into, certainly they were tied to the CIA. In the crisis situation here, you have these various crisis centers in the White House, the Situation Room, at NSA in particular, DEFSMAC, at the CIA Crisis Center, the DOD, the NMCC. You have all these centers that are all tied together in real time. If something breaks in one, they're all on the net instantly, in seconds. So they had to be connected there. Yet, nobody is doing anything. Now, the system cannot have deteriorated so much that it was totally out of the loop, I don't believe, in the 20 years since I've been in the Pentagon. And so that's another question is, again, people wanted it to happen. They may not have known precisely what it was going to be, and it may have really overpowered their imagination had they really recognized what was going to happen in terms of the ultimate effect. But they weren't doing anything because they wanted it to happen. That's the only conclusion that you can draw, and there's nothing to oppose that conclusion whatsoever in the 9/11 Commission report. report.
You know, one of the frightening things to me is that the Morgan Stanley apparently had the top two floors of the South Tower. And, of course, after the plane crashed into the North Tower, one announcement came over the loudspeaker in the South Tower saying, stay at your seats, stay at your seats. The people, of course, looking out the window, they can see the flames billowing from the North Tower. They can see people plunging out of the windows and the bodies falling. And the announcement comes over the loudspeaker, stay at your seats. Well, the man in charge of security at the Morgan Stanley, raced up and down the aisles with a megaphone saying, we're under attack, get out. And he got all 1,700 people out. 1,700 people more would have died if he hadn't done that, and nobody has ever asked, why did they put that announcement out on the over the loudspeaker to stay at your jobs? Don't leave. Don't abandon the building. Don't leave the building. Everything's fine. Because they had to know that there was another plane on the way. Nobody ever addressed that in the 9/11 Commission report, or the only person addressed that, to my knowledge, was Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband perished in the South Tower. But it's amazing how the investigating committees just totally ignored that, and they never asked who gave that order.
And so we end up with a situation today where it's all, our attention is totally diverted. Everything is fine now. They're reorganizing the intelligence community, and they've appointed Porter Goss to head the CIA, and he'll soon probably be the National Intelligence Director. And they're going to have a little kind of a planning function attached to the counterterrorism office. Note, I think there's only one. I think they dropped the one at the NSC. It's all a diversion, a placebo that the public is being fed. And I guess it's not an awful lot different from the Warren Commission report.
But you know, the interesting thing to me is that a recent Zogby poll of the people in New York, now I assume it's New York City, but they found that 50% of the people polled within the last month did not believe the government story. They believe that there was foreknowledge and that certain people in government allowed this to happen. Now, that poll is up on the internet, and anybody could type in Google Zogby poll, 911 poll on Zogby. I'm sure you could pull that down. That's not getting much play, though, in the general media. But I think there are an awful lot of people out across America who know something is seriously wrong. That, to me, is the most encouraging part of this. What's happened is a terrible tragedy. Yeah. But more and more people realize we're not getting the truth.
A question that I would raise and add to your list of questions there, Dr. Stan, is, we've been listening to this debate between Kerry and Bush, and of course all the banter that goes on in between it and in preparation for it. Why has not Senator Kerry raised the whole issue of 9/11? I mean, here you have a president who's running on his war on terrorism and saying he would be better commander than Kerry. The obvious thing for Kerry to have raised is, how can you say that? Here you have a person who has been the commander-in-chief, and he didn't take any action to stop what happened. When they had plenty of time, as a matter of fact, nobody did anything, and it's clear they didn't want anybody to do anything. You know, how do you want to re-elect somebody like that who has shown you exactly what they will do and how ineffective they will do it and how much they will lie and misrepresent the situation afterwards? There's an excellent report on that, incidentally, that was put out by a congressman who's not one of my favorite congressmen, but nevertheless, this report was very excellent, sponsored by Henry Waxman. It is amazing, but he looks at, you know, a complete poll of all the public statements. This was done not by him, of course, but by the Congressional Research Service, a very short report, the statements by the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, the President, the National Security Advisor, and all kids saying, you know, look at what they said, how many of these were lies, how many of them were misrepresentations.
Where can people get that report by Henry Waxman?
They can get that on the Internet.
Okay, fine. What would be the title they'd look for, do you think?
Gosh, I wish I'd brought it on.
Henry Waxman 9/11 Commission Report. Maybe that would get it down. Something
on
like that.
The statements regarding... The statements regarding the invasion of Iraq, I think.
All right, fine. Well, I sort of laughed when you said that because I went back and testified before Waxman's committee, congressional committee one time on the AIDS epidemic. And mm-hmm. all during my testimony, he was talking to his aide next door. You know, and first when the gentleman had come back with me, another doctor, started to testify why Waxman got up and walked out. I mean, he is such a rude little man. But that doesn't mean that some of the things he says aren't true. As you say, he may not be our favorite individual, but it doesn't matter whether we like him or not. What is he saying is what he's saying really true and provocative.
And I read through the report and the statements that they had listed. And it was interesting because they're all accurate from what I could see. They all were appropriately labeled as misrepresentations or lies, or false. They didn't use the word lie, actually. I think they can use the word false. And not only that, but they looked at the frequency of them and saw that they increased with frequency before the congressional decision on money and before, on the 2 weeks before of the invasion of Iraq and another time also. So they were very, the misrepresentations in frequency were key to the politics of the situation. And you know, he didn't do it. He just commissioned it by some of the, I guess, the Democratic staff or something like that. But what they came out with, I thought, was far more insightful in a sense than the 9-1-1 commission report, all 500-some pages of it.
Well, I'm intrigued by your statement about Senator Kerry, and the question is, why isn't he bringing up 9-1-1? I mean, this is certainly something everybody is concerned about, and all he has to do is say, you know, Bush got a presidential briefing, daily briefing on August 6th that said Osama bin Laden determined to attack America. Determined to strike America, I think was the title of it. And they listed, of course, all the reasons why, you know, that he was thinking of hijacking planes. They were certainly observing the buildings in Washington, D.C. and New York City. Why, when the president had that on August 6th, fully 5 weeks before the attack, why didn't he do anything? That would be such a telling point for Senator Kerry if he wanted to bring it out. But I suspect that it's really all smoke and mirrors. It's, you know, like Abbott and Costello. They put on a great show.
Yeah, you know, the straw that broke the camel's back on that aspect was during the debate. Bush several times said, you know, you made the decision. You saw exactly the same intelligence I had. Now, anybody with half a brain knows that that is absolutely wrong. You know, the people in the Senate Intelligence Committee or the House Intelligence Committee do not get the same information the president gets. And there's no question about that. They get some of the stuff. But there's so much stuff that just goes to the president and doesn't go to any of the intelligence committees unless they're supposed to have it. I don't mean legally. I mean, the White House says, yeah, give them that.
I think there were only six people who got the PDBs under the Clinton. I think probably 20 or 30 people got them. But under the Bush administration, they limited access to information. And you have to wonder why, in the face of the growing terrorist threat and the fact that they knew an attack was coming, why they limited access to just so few people at the very top of the Bush administration. We'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up this evening's program. Our guest has been Dr. Joe Douglas here at Radio Liberty. Well, our guest is Dr. Joe Douglas. Joe, we've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program. What thoughts would you like to leave with our with our listeners this evening?
Well, I think that last one's very interesting that we've been talking about there, Dr. Stan. You know, Kerry is an excellent debater. He's smart. You know, he knows what's happening. Why is he just not crucifying Bush on 9/11, on the invasion of Iraq, on the falsification of intelligence, on everything else? Particularly since, as you mentioned before, the public is extremely suspicious and don't believe they're being told things. And you know, this is a real question: is the whole thing that much of a fraud that they can't even, they don't want to let anybody recognize how bad it is and what is happening, because it'll reflect on the whole political process and let the people recognize how bad our political process is broken. And the second thought I would say is, take a look at that report at financialsense.com on the 9-1-1 commission report and appraise it. It lays it out just using the material that they had there. It's a little bit long, but read through it. Send it to your friends. Nothing is going to happen around this nation until we make it happen. And the best way we can do is spread the word, particularly right now, and get it into the hands of some people in the news media. Maybe we'll find some people other than those in talk radio that are willing to write about some of this stuff and raise the questions that aren't being raised in the debate.
Well, do you have a website at all, Joe?
No, I do not.
All right, fine. Well, Dr. Douglas has written several excellent books. One's Red Cocaine. Is that still available?
It certainly is. It's available at Amazon.com. And it's also available through the publisher, which is can be found on the Internet, Edward Harrell.
All right, that's Red Cocaine, an excellent book going into the background of the cocaine traffic, which, of course, is being financed facilitated by the communists throughout the country, just as they're certainly working to corrupt our society with heroin, I'm sure. But, of course, we're not talking about that because the communists are our allies now. A president looked in Putin's eyes and said, Vladimir, I could tell he was an honest man, a good man. I could trust him. And then, of course, you want to get Dr. Joe Douglas's book, Betrayed, which we carry. And this goes in the background of what happened to the men we left behind. Our number, 1-800-544-8927. Joe, thank you so very much for being with us. It's always a pleasure having you here as a guest on Radio Liberty.
Oh, thanks, Dr. Stan, and I look forward to another time.
Okay, fine. Well, we want to get you on our other programs on the same subject. Till then, may the Lord be with you.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this evening was Dr. Joe Douglas. And, of course, you can get his book, Red Cocaine, at Amazon.com or through the publisher. If you can just go to Google, type in the Red Cocaine, and then you get the publisher. We do carry his book, Betrayed. We think it's an important book, well-researched, with information on the men we abandon. And remember, a nation that will abandon its fighting men will one day betray its citizens. Ronald Reagan said that, and I believe it's true. If you want to know really what happened on 911, why, you can read my newsletters on my website at RadioLiberty.com. We have a great new book. It's called The Terrorist Timeline, written by Paul Thompson, actually. We have interviewed him, and we'll be putting together my interviews with him and with Peter Lance onto a four-tape set in the very near future. But A Terrorist Timeline is an excellent book. We recommend that to you. And, we carry other books on what happened on 9/11. We still have a few copies of Bin Laden, the man who declared war on America. And if you'd like a list of the books we have, we'd be glad to send you our catalog. And our list of our tape sets and the videos we have on what happened on 9/11, the day that changed America forever. So give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you'd like a copy of our August newsletter. Why it tells you what Warren Buffett and Alan Greenspan really think about what's happening financially. If you haven't read the August newsletter, I think you're in for a surprise to find out what Warren Buffett feels about the future of the American currency. And if Warren Buffett is willing to gamble with $19 billion that the dollar is going to fall precipitously, I think you should be concerned about that as well. And, of course, this is all documented in our August newsletter. Our September newsletter goes with the control of the media. And, of course, the origin of our central bank here in the United States and how it has been used to control our money, to create money out of nothing so that a small group of people could purchase the media and essentially control what the American people think as we move towards from freedom to fascism, as we move away from our destiny as a Christian nation into rapidly becoming a pagan or anti-Christian nation. So if you'd like a free copy of our September newsletter, we'll send that as well. We'll only send you one because, of course, we really hope that you want to subscribe to our newsletter, or better still, that you want to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we reach out across America 5 hours every day, somewhere in the nation on radio, 5 hours a day on the internet, and we're on about 5 different internets now. Then, of course, our shortwave program is 4 hours a day. We're on about 4 different satellites. So you could ask your local station if they'd be willing to pull down our programming. And then, of course, we hope that many of you will, of course, tell your friends about our programs and encourage them to listen to the internet, radio, shortwave, or satellite for that matter. Then you can go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can, of course, listen to our programs live on the internet there. You can listen to our archive programs if you miss them during the daytime, during the regular broadcasting. And, of course, there are links to gcnlive.com and americannewsnet.com that also carry some of our programming. So your job is to tell other people about our program, and our job is to try to get the fascinating guests like Dr. Joe Douglas and others who will give us insight into what's happening. A wonderful guest this afternoon, Frederick Forsyth, the man who wrote The Day of the Jackal, calling us from England about, of course, the move towards the European Union and the destruction of British national sovereignty, part of the same program that's pushing NAFTA, the World Trade Organization, but now the Free Trade Zone of the Americas. And, of course, this will destroy our currency, it will destroy our sovereignty, and will eventually merge us into the New World Order, the New World Religion. And so pray for America. Pray for revival, because we're involved in a spiritual battle that's being played out on a political and ideological and cultural battlefield. And then please remember to pray for my ministry, Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Remember our November 6th meeting here in the Monterey Bay area, Saturday, November 6th. Until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here again, here at Radio Liberty, coming here from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls until we ask for them, because we have this evening certainly one of my favorite guests, and I know the favorite guest of many of our listeners, Joel Skousen. And Joel is the editor of World Affairs Brief, and we're going to be talking about current events. Hi, Joel. How are you doing tonight?
I'm just fine, Dr. Stan. Always good to be with you.
Well, we certainly are living in exciting times, aren't we?
We are.
What are we going to talk about tonight?
Well, let's first start with a couple of legal issues. The Supreme Court has agreed to give us a long-awaited review of the eminent domain process. Ever since the 1984 Hawaii case, Hawaii Housing Authority versus Midkiff, the public use justification for eminent domain takings by government has been expanded. You know, it used to be that government could only take it for direct public purposes like military housing or military bases, special roads or waterways that had to do with the overall public good. And then that was expanded in a Supreme Court case written by Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, essentially in the Hawaii case, opened a Pandora's box. Basically, it included private developments that served a public purpose instead of direct public projects. So this makes everybody's property liable for confiscation for greedy redevelopment agencies within local jurisdictions. You know, anxious to bulldoze older homes and trailer courts and replace them with bigger developments that promise to pay higher property taxes. That's always the lure that they use to convince the public for. But, you know, now that these excesses have occurred, I mean, every jurisdiction that I know of has been taking residential houses to sell the property to developers at a bargain price in exchange for the promise of increased jobs and property taxes or an increased tax base. So, in essence, there's a new case here, an eminent domain action in the Fort Trumbull neighborhood of New London, Connecticut, an area that has experienced decades of economic decline. So in 1998, Pfizer Incorporated, the big drug company, announced plans to build a big research facility. And the city decided to use the opportunity to develop a 90-acre site, including a waterfront hotel, a conference center, new residences, all private developments. And the improvements, the city said, would revitalize the area. They always say that, would yield new tax revenues and fund more services for the community. And, true to form, the city began to acquire, by eminent domain, property from owners who wouldn't sell voluntarily. And these were some significant properties of long historical value by people, and so they've gone to court in a class action suit. This, of course, takes place under the Fifth Amendment, where it talks about eminent domain is a constitutional allowance, but it requires that there be just compensation. But this is, as I say, always been heretofore limited. It never should be taking one person's property to give to another commercial endeavor. The Institute for Justice, one of my favorite public interest law firms, is representing property owners who don't want to leave. And the Supreme Court decided to take it up, and I think it's clearly time to revisit the issue and to hold the line again on development for taking private property to give to other people.
Take your property and give it to some developer, and who knows what money may change hands behind the scenes. We'll be back here in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here. Our guest is Joel Skousen. And, you know, our founding fathers realized that if men were angels, why we wouldn't need government, and that you really couldn't trust government officials at any level with power, because that power would be certainly misused sooner or later. So at least as far as the federal government, they limited the power of the federal government and their ability to interfere in the lives of the people. And really, all they were ready to do was very limited things, give us a standard wage and marriages measures, but they're not doing a very good job, and giving us a stable currency, and they're not doing a very good job with that. And they're supposed to defend America, but we can't even defend our own borders. But we can defend the borders of Iraq, but not the borders of America. So then we get down to private property. Are there such things as private property rights? Does that have anything to do with freedom? Or should local officials be able to take your property away? Because, after all, they think that they can expand the tax base. But also, of course, the developers will make a tremendous profit over this. So what do you think is going to happen, Joel?
Well, I think there will be some limitations now on the use of eminent domain. I think that they're going to have to curtail this. It's getting out of hand, and the Supreme Court is anxious from time to time to show that they're doing the right thing. It helps justify the illusion in the American people that this is a legitimate separation of powers within government, and I think there's open collusion between the various separate divisions of government that used to be and are supposed to be under a fiduciary relationship, separate and without collusion. But, you know, it's interesting that even the fact of the old increase the tax base argument is now no longer valid. Recent studies have shown that the justification to promote redevelopment and giving of tax breaks to big corporations to bring them into a town, rarely, if ever, fully compensate cities for the total of increased government services that must be developed to handle this new growth brought about by luring in big corporations. You know, when you factor in the cost of new sewers, new water systems, streets, and schools especially, the net taxable burden to taxpayers increases with growth, just the opposite of what redevelopment experts claim. Now, of course, they skew the figures to show a net positive gain, but they clearly exclude long-term bonding projects and other things which they should include. And when you factor those things in, you find that government efficiency goes down with growth, and the net cost per capita goes up, both for crime, police services, net taxable revenues to the state or the city or the local jurisdiction. So it really is an illusion that they're selling to people about increasing the tax base.
Hold that thought for just a moment there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, I guess, this evening, Joel Skousen, and he's talking about mentioning that the local government always justifies taking people's private property away from them under an eminent domain by saying, oh, well, this is going to increase the tax base, we're going to get so much more money, then we can provide more services. But as he points out, the services required by these new projects usually cost far more than the increase in the tax base. And so this whole idea that we're really benefiting the people by seizing private property from people who don't want to sell is really not true. Would that be a fair statement?
Absolutely. And it's been shown in many new recent studies that the net cost to communities is always higher with a high incentive growth program luring big corporations. And incidentally, even the jobs that they promise from big corporations don't materialize. Most corporations, when they move in, hire at least 75% of the people from outside the local jurisdiction. They bring in other people, which of course puts an extra load on the infrastructure of the city, and that's what causes the increase in growth or in cost of growth.
And of course, they've got to put in their sewers and their schools and all the other things that go with this, and so that taxes have to go up to pay for all the things that they're doing. And the final analysis, why the people lose, unless of course you have extensive property holdings, then the value of your property goes up. So the people who know what's going to happen are investing in property, buying it low, selling it high, and the average person loses. That's the way it seems to work.
Well, only if they actually sell the property do they gain the reap the rewards. Most people end up paying increased property taxes because of inflation and increased property valuations that occur when you start to have redevelopment going in around you. And so they end up paying more in taxes to government. Walter Williams ended up pointing out another egregious excess in federal government management of private property or controlling. This, of course, is only one of many such things, but it's particularly that the courts are starting to side with individual property owners. This is the case of John Rapanos of Michigan, 68 years old. He faces a 10-month federal imprisonment charge and up to $10 million in fines for doing what? For clearing and grading 175 acres of fallow farmland that he'd owned since 1950, with the intention, of course, of constructing a shopping center. Here's a person who wants to develop his own property, not taking anyone else's. And when the shopping center deal fell through, he leased the land to a local grain farmer, and now he's been charged with a crime. What is the crime? Well, he had, of course, a few depressions which occasionally had water in them because he leveled the land and filled in those depressions with fill material. He has now been charged with a violation of the Clean Water Act. In the eyes of the U.S. Corps of Engineers, you can't fill in any depressions in your land without their permission. Now, another good public interest law firm, conservative one, the Pacific Legal Foundation, is taking of his case. And they are, of course, arguing the rational thing that isolated pools and puddles were magically transformed into navigable waters to meet the requirements of this act. You know, the Corps of Engineers claiming they were stopovers for migratory birds. With this, you know, kind of reasoning of the courts in their previous cases, as well as the Corps of Engineers, you could go to jail if you had a tree stump, you know, ground out and filled in the hole. So in the early days of early stages of the Rapanos case, it's very interesting what U.S. District Judge Lawrence Zotkov said, noting that he had just recently sentenced a drug dealer the day before to a very light term because of mandatory sentencing requirements. Here he said, here we have a person who commits a crime of selling dope, and the government asked me to put him in prison for 10 months. That was the minimum sentencing guidelines. And now we have an American citizen who buys land, owns it for, how many years is that? Almost 60 years, pays for it with his own money. He moves sand from one end to the other, doesn't even import it from somewhere else, and the government wants me to give him 63 months in prison. Now, that isn't our system gone crazy. I don't know what it is, and I'm not going to do it, said the judge. So, Rapanos' sentencing has been delayed because of the constitutionality now of the federal criminal sentencing guidelines. In other words, this case has led to a wholesale, because the courts have now put in jeopardy the whole federal sentencing guideline. In essence, the court ruled in his opinion that this was a taking of the prerogative of a juror. The juror should be the only ones that should decide how serious the crime is and meeting out punishment. And they're making a good case that the Supreme Court is now going to take up. They're going to pass on the legality of all of these mandatory sentencing guidelines as a taking of the prerogative of jurors. And I think they have a good case on this. Because there are so many technicalities now that require mandatory sentences that, without jury nullification, without the jury being able to be told that they have the power to rule on both the law and the facts of the case, these things have put many people's lives and property in real jeopardy because of a technical violation of the law.
You know, the thing that bothers me, Joel, is that we used to call wetlands swamps, and we wanted to get rid of them because they bred mosquitoes and they bred all sorts of diseases, and now, of course, they've changed it. They're no longer swamps. They're wetlands, as if there's something magical about wetlands. But the problem is that now we have, of course, the West Nile virus, and the West Nile virus is carried by mosquitoes. Mosquitoes, of course, grow in swampy water or standing water. So I would think that we would want to do everything we possibly could with this new threat that threatens the lives of American citizens to do away with these wetlands, try it, certainly in the area where people are living, to try to do away with that. And yet, of course, this man is threatened with imprisonment and massive fines because he did what was logical, not only to benefit his own property, but for his property to benefit the lives of his neighbors. Why do they want to give breeding areas to mosquitoes?
Well, of course, they make the argument that no one can prove or disprove, and that is that any loss of wetlands means that birds have less places to migrate to. The birds have been shown to be extremely resilient in terms of being able to find other places, and you would have to make the case that all other waterways are just so packed with birds that there's no other place for them to find sufficient, landing zones or forage or food, and that just isn't true. I mean, there's a tremendous amount of excess capacity in the waterways which are used by migratory birds. Walter Williams ends his essay by saying, and by the way, he's one of my favorite economists at George Mason University, a real true free market economist, libertarian. He said, but they cannot do it alone. He says, we must help them. Remember Benjamin Franklin's admonition, make yourself sheep and the wolves will eat you. So if anybody wants to support Institute of Justice or Pacific Legal Foundation, then go to their websites, which is for Institute of Justice, it's ij.org, and Pacific Legal Foundation is pacificlegal.org. Both very worthy of everyone's support.
PacificLegal.org, is that it?
Yes, PacificLegal.org. O-R-G.
The thing I would also point out is that those nasty mosquitoes are infecting and killing the birds, too, with West Nile virus.
Right.
So,
especially
what we really
Nile.
Ought to do, if we're really concerned about the birds, would be to try to get the areas that there wouldn't be the mosquitoes that would kill the birds. So, this whole thing is organized foolishness. It's all rhetoric. It's simply a cover for an agenda, and that is to take away private property rights. Take away private property rights. You've taken away the very essence of freedom, and where is massive, mass outcry from the American people. I mean, they would think that the average individual realized that, they can take away his property rights, they can take away your property rights.
Well, you know, it's the slow boiling of the frog syndrome. People read about people's property being taken for a redevelopment. They say, tisk, 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 that's really too bad, you know. That really shouldn't be, you know. But because it isn't their property, it isn't their ox that's being gored, they tend to let it go. And, you know, that's one of the basic rules they have in incrementally taking away liberty is follow the rule that never inconvenience or make the majority mad at any one time, only pick on small minorities who can't defend themselves. That's always been one of the problems with, you know, democracy. People say, well, if you don't like the law, change it. Well, to change it means you have to be more than a minority. You've got to go get the majority to get interested. What if it's a small violation of the building code? How do you go get the majority of people to listen to the technical arguments of why a small issue in the building code should be changed by law and go through all the bureaucracy when it's almost impossible for people to understand the technical issues, let alone build up a majority rule to get a change? So these things are very difficult when done by bureaucratic edicts.
And, of course, when you challenge the bureaucrats, they'll come after you. And, of course, they're above the law, and they'll make your life miserable. You'll never get another building permit as long as you live in that area, at least if they have anything to say about it.
Well, or worse yet, they just won't let you live in your house.
Right.
You know, they will deny you an occupancy permit. And, you know, so much of the building code, and, you know, having designed houses all of my career, I can tell you that very little of the building code has to do with real outright safety. A good most of it has to do with, you know, things that bureaucrats want to see done in terms of housing. They just want to see things up to a certain standard. I mean, there shouldn't be, there's anything, nothing safe about having finished floor coverings in a house. You know, the fact you can't move in, you know, without carpeting or some kind of finished floor is just ridiculous. It used to be that poor people could pull themselves up by the bootstraps because they could live in a substandard house, a shack or a log cabin. In Latin American countries, they'll build scavenge from the garbage dumps and build shanties right next to the dump on scrap pieces of metal and wood. And they're not paying rent. They're getting ahead in life. And they move off after a few years and go upward and are mobile. But if you have to move into a pristine, code-developed home, you may never get out of debt and move ahead in life.
And how many people can afford the average home here in California, which is, I don't know, it's about $400,000,
something right.
Like that.
Yeah.
Ridiculous. Well, we're going to be back in just a moment with our special guest, Joel Skousen, World Affairs Brief, and it's so important that you have the information. You want to go to his website, as I do first thing every morning, worldaffairsbrief.com. That's worldaffairsbrief.com. Get an overview of everything significant that happened the day before. Fascinating source of information, worldaffairsbrief.com. Well, I guess this evening, Joel Skousen from worldaffairsbrief.com. And, of course, Joel, why don't you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you, get copies of your newsletter, and hopefully subscribe to it.
Well, as you just mentioned, the best way is to go to my website, worldaffairsbrief.com. They can click on the subscribe button. It has an automatic process whereby you can use a credit card or instructions on how to send in a check. You can as well get a print edition free sample for those that don't have access to the Internet by calling courtesy of Genesis Communication, an 800 number. That's 877-518-5888. That's 877-518-5888. And there's lots of other interesting things on the website. As Stan, as you mentioned, there are the daily postings from my fine researchers on all the top news stories of each day, especially the ones that don't get full press in the establishment press that you need to read about. And I make my analysis at the end of each week based upon those stories, and I pick the ones that indicate there's something significantly missing from that you know, people appreciate knowing about, the type of things that we talk about here. And there's also a great deal of background material on the right-hand side of my webpage where you can talk about the many government cover-ups that have occurred. That's one of the most important evidences of collusion and conspiracy in government, is when you cover up for various things, whether it's the TWA missile shoot down of that airliner, or the killing of Vince Foster or Ron Brown, the death of JFK, understanding the collusion between various forms of government and covering up for those crimes, and putting Patsies in jail for those crimes is very instructive in terms of understanding the details. It's all too easy in life to cast dispersions on what the news media derisively calls conspiracy theorists. But there is a great deal of evidence for conspiracy, and that's what makes the difference between credible ideas and the difference between wacko theories and theories that really have weight behind them. And I, ask people to really consider the evidence. So they can go to my website and check out a lot of the research that I've done in the past on some of these other issues and make a decision for themselves if, in fact, we have a government that really tells us the truth, or whether or not they're essentially lying about most of the issues, and that they have a hidden agenda, which I talk about also.
All right, well, let's go to Russell, who's calling us from Austin, Texas. Hi, Russell. How are you doing?
Yeah, hi, Doctor. Listen, I'd like to ask your guest, I think I'm on Mr. Skousen, right?
Joel Skousen.
Oh, Skousen.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm having trouble. Well, listen, I'd like to ask him, has he ever taken a look at the Confiscation Act of 1861 and also the Reconstruction Acts that came out that same year?
Oh, yeah, certainly.
We lost
a great deal of liberties,
are you aware of what...
Well, please let Joel answer. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Then when he's answered, you go ahead. Go ahead, Joel.
Well, I'm stating that's one of the reasons why I think that Abraham Lincoln was killed, is that there was to be a takeover of and a loss of many constitutional liberties in a Reconstruction process. Many of those corrupt laws had their beginnings in 1861.
Okay, do you have anything else, Russell?
Yeah, I'd just like to comment, because that law has never been repealed, and the Confiscation Act has never been repealed, and it states pretty specifically in there what the status is of everybody in this country. And we are considered to be insurrectionists, and it also speaks about the right of the government, if you want to call it a right, to confiscate people's property without anything. I mean, it's considered to be a prize, like the old laws of the sea out there back during the British Empire back then.
Well, of course, that has to do with confiscation under the Piracy Act. So, okay, fine. Well, thanks, Russell.
The difference, interestingly enough, is that they... Even though those haven't been repealed, they are careful not to use them very often, lest people rise up against them. And that's what's interesting about the emergency powers that they use. I mean, we're still living on emergencies that have been declared for numerous, other than which, those emergency powers are draconian. And if you ever push the government, as an individual in some of these court cases, they will tell you, you're under emergency law and you don't have any constitutional rights. But they are careful not to do that openly, lest they alert a large amount of people and they have some, rebellion on their hands. So I think we have to be careful, at looking at the technicalities of law, because they pick and choose of how they utilize that in order to maintain the illusion that we still have we still have constitutional republican processes.
And that, like the illusion of the two-party process, so that we pick our presidential candidate every 4 years, but it's an illusion. Anybody would like something on the Emergency Powers Act? We have a wonderful publication came out of the Senate in 1972 over the name of Frank Church, and I think Senator Frank Church and Senator Mathiasen, two Democrats who were so concerned about the emergency powers and the fact that we are losing our constitutional rights, and of course it is simply a facade that we still have them, trying to awaken the American people. But so if you'd like a free copy of that, just write in or give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. We'll send you that. A treatise, that's a government report on the emergency powers that still in force, just exactly as many of those laws back post-Reconstruction, Civil War Reconstruction, are still in force. But I think Joel's absolutely right. The last thing they want the American people to realize, that the power of the dictators are there. They are the law of the land, and one day, I fear, they will be imposed upon us with draconian results. Go ahead, Joel.
I'm ready to switch topics to Iraq if you desire.
Please do. We've got a couple of minutes before we have to go to the half-hour break.
Please go right ahead. I think it's important to realize that things are getting much more organized in terms of the insurrection there, the anti-occupation forces. There's an excellent article that came out in the Christian Science Monitor by Brad Knickerbocker talking about classic guerrilla warfare building in Iraq. You know, what's interesting is that the attacks seem much more coordinated. We have daily attacks now. Car bombings are becoming, you know, the weapon of choice. I don't think these things are going to wind down for, you know, even two decades because of all of the ammunition stockpiles and explosive stockpiles that they've got left over from this war, which the U.S. Isn't even close to confiscating yet. Guerrilla warfare really is a very underrated and, frankly, very successful form of warfare in human history. Guerrillas don't have to win the entire battle. They just simply have to wear down the occupation forces and wait till the opponent goes home. Now, in this case, of course, I think the opponents, the American Bush administration, has an agenda that exceeds simply putting Iraq back together. They have a globalist agenda, an antagonism agenda, and they intend to manipulate the Middle East process. They have other victims on the table. I think Iran and Syria are very close to being attacked. Probably not this year, of course, but it could be as early as next year. And so at some point or another, I think we're going to see another Middle East war and a conflict, and the U.S. is going to be right in the middle of it with this big base of operations they have now in Iraq.
In fact, I really believe that we went to a war with Iraq primarily because it would be very easy to defeat, because, of course, it had been really deprived of the ability to get military equipment and funding, and the military was pretty much in disarray. But we needed that as base, because I think Iran certainly has been working with Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and this terrorist movement far more involved than Iraq ever was. But we couldn't tell the American people that. When we get back, I certainly want to get Joel Skousen's thoughts and whether he agrees or disagrees with that. But I believe we specifically went into Iraq. Of course, it was great as a diversion. It was great for to get the oil. It was great, of course, to punish Saddam Hussein for beginning to take a payment for his oil in euros rather than in dollars. But I really think, of course, that we went there to establish that base, which will be used for military adventures, which are coming very soon. We interviewed a gentleman on Friday who was attending a Christian meeting in Washington, D.C., last Friday, and he told me it. And talk to somebody in the State Department who said America will have a presence in the Middle East for 50 years, for 50 long years. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Joel Skousen. What are your thoughts about my fear that my belief, really, that we went to Iraq because that was the easiest nut to place so we could develop our military bases with the idea of expanding the war later? Do you think that there's a possibility that's true?
Well, I think there's much evidence to support that. Iraq was the easiest one because, first of all, it was under sanctions, so that Saddam Hussein was somewhat inhibited from rebuilding his military forces. Russia was playing along by not rebuilding openly the kinds of forces that they had prior to the first and during the first Gulf War, by the way, where Russia was actively resupplying Iraq. So Iraq was truly vulnerable, and the mere threat of the invasion building as rapidly did caused Saddam Hussein to move his weapons of mass destruction out of the country. In fact, we have just another confirmation of that that's come out this past week, which I covered in the World Affairs Brief. Lieutenant General Michael DeLong of the United States Marine Corps, he's now retired, so he's kind of free to speak out. Until last September, a year ago, he was number two in command in Iraq under Tommy Franks. He revealed Sunday in an interview that U.S. military intelligence had determined that weapons of mass destruction were being smuggled out of the country as the U.S. prepared to invade. here's his quote, "I do know for a fact that some of those weapons went into Syria, Lebanon, and Iran." Now, what that means really is that he not only saw the briefings where that was spelled out in black and white, but he probably saw the satellite photos as well, because those would have been part of the briefing papers about preparing to invade. And the mere fact that he was specific in saying the U.S. had knowledge of it going to Syria, Lebanon, and Iran means that there was a great move on the part of Saddam Hussein to distribute those weapons elsewhere. Now, the big question, of course, is why did the U.S. suppress its own intelligence about Syria, about Lebanon, Iran, and even Iraq? Well, first of all, admitting Syria's role would have denied them the rationale for attacking Iraq, which was already designated as the future U.S. basis of operations there. Now, this was in part, I believe, because of Iraq's oil reserve, but mostly because of its strategic central location within the Middle East. I think that's why they picked Iraq. They intend to go after Iran and Syria, and Iraq is smack between those two countries. It divides those two countries from being able to provide mutual support, at least to a certain extent. And Lebanon, of course, is being supported both by Syria and Lebanon. As I've stated before, the U.S. is building 14 new military bases.
Hold that thought for just one moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Joel Skousen was saying, and I think this is really so significant, that General Michael DeLong, who was a Marine general, second in command in Iraq, had made a public statement, now that he's retired, that he had seen the intelligence and was convinced that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. They were smuggled into Syria, into Iran, and probably into Lebanon immediately before the United States attack. So the administration knows that the weapons of mass destruction were not imaginary, they were real, and yet, of course, they've withheld this information from the American people. They've allowed, of course, Senator Kerry to attack George Bush, saying he lied to us, there are no weapons of mass destruction. Of course there were weapons of mass destruction, and they were smuggled out, and we have this from so many sources, other reliable sources other than Joel Skousen, who's told me this about a year ago, Senator Dor Gold, former Israeli ambassador to the United Nations, told me that when we talked. Avi Lifkin has verified that fact. We have articles out of the Insight magazine before it, of course, was closed down because they no longer could get advertisers because they were critical of the CIA. Well, I shouldn't say the CIA closed them down. Let's just say that nobody would advertise in Insight magazine anymore, so they were closed down. But they talked about this. So there's no question in my mind that the government knows that the weapons of mass destruction were real. And yet, of course, Tony Blair is almost having to go before the parliament and apologize for not being forthcoming. George Bush has apologized for not being truthful. And yet he was being truthful. I never understood why they haven't told the American people the truth.
Well, of course, there's... you know, it's very obvious from the sources that I have in Washington that the U.S. was planning on invading Iraq even before Afghanistan. They happened to choose Afghanistan because it gave them a more credible belief that Afghanistan harboring al-Qaeda or the mythical al-Qaeda, there's no real evidence other than what the U.S. tells us that this organization exists as a worldwide threat to the rest of the world. But... in any case, the evidence strongly suggests that the U.S. is already planning to attack Iraq before they went into Afghanistan, but they had to pick Afghanistan first. It was easy, and as soon as they were halfway into the battle, the Marine generals have indicated to me through other sources that they were just livid when the U.S. started pulling out all the resources to prepare for Iraq, even before they had consolidated things. That's why Afghanistan went unconquered, essentially. They got Kabul, made it appear as if they had the entire country pacified, and it's not. The insurgency is building again there with greater power. One of the experts in terrorism made this statement, and he said, this was Professor Stephen Metz of the Army War College. He says, most importantly, the insurgents haven't made much effort to develop a coherent political program or identify a leadership. I see this as their most serious weakness. Now, I disagree with Metz on this. I believe this is, in fact, an advantage. It's hard to fight an enemy with a distributed, hidden leadership. You don't know who to target. The U.S. continues to blame a great deal of the insurgency on foreign Arabs in being infiltrated in the country. There certainly are some of those, but there are so many people who have had their property or loved ones killed by Americans that they constitute a constant source of new recruits for terrorism in Iraq, besides the normal Sunni tribalists, the former Saddam regime loyalists, the Mahdi militia fighters for anti-U.S. cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. And there, if they kill those few leaders, there'll be others to rise in their place because you have a large groundswell of opposition to U.S. forces there. But in any case, it appears as if both Syria and Iran are playing with a death wish here. You know, Iran is rattling sabers at both Israel and George Bush. It's kind of their version of Bush's bring it on foolishness regarding increased guerrilla attacks in Iraq. Iran has twice issued in-your-face threats of retaliation to both Israel and the U.S. troops in Iraq if either attempts to launch a preemptive strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. Now, even though Iran would be a more formidable foe to the U.S. than Iraq, it is clearly not in Iran's best interest to provoke an attack from the U.S., you know, right next door to in Iraq. So we have to ask ourselves, is Iran playing the role of bait to provoke an Israeli or U.S. attack so that its bigger ally, Russia, can have an excuse to intervene? That's a possibility. Probably not an imminent possibility, but later on when Russia is ready, the Middle East could possibly provide that trigger event, which could lead to World War III.
And, of course, we're doing everything we can to build up Russia's oil wealth so she would be able to finance a war with the United States. We're pouring billions and billions and billions of dollars from American corporations to build up their pipelines and build up their pumping facilities and, of course, make Russia's oil profitable enough so she can become a major military threat again.
Well, that's right. And, it's there have been... no small number of people who have, talked about some of the collusion between U.S. Intelligence and military forces with Russia and China and helping to build them up even militarily. I covered that in the previous World Affairs brief the week before of an insider who became a whistleblower in 1983, went to work for one of the major... U.S. contractors, military contractors working on the SDI project, and in the vetting process, he was told, you're going to be working with Russian and Chinese technicians, and if you refuse to do so, we'll make sure that you never work in the nuclear industry again. And he declined because he was very patriotic, and they really put pressure on him. So even after he had declined, they came back and still tried to get him to work for it. But there's a very open agenda within the community that these people know about, that they are to betray American secrets. Happened to use aircraft. I have a subscriber who used to work at Hughes, and he said, we were livid at Hughes when, during the first George Bush administration, the Hughes aircraft and secret facilities, part of the factory, were open to Chinese military people who would come and look over their shoulder, started to protest. In fact, they started a semi-strike, a work slowdown. The company reacted by shutting down the factory on Saturday, locking out the workers, and letting the Chinese have the run of the factory on Saturday without the workers being there. Now, you don't do that in top-secret facilities that neither you and I can get into, Stan, unless there is a secret agenda to truly transfer high-tech military information to these countries. And we would ask, why would our country do this? I think it really can only be explained by the fact that there is a globalist agenda. A globalist agenda really requires that you have conflict, even world wars, to cause Americans who are very jealous of their sovereignty, or at least they used to be, and wedded to their constitution, to give that up and agree to a globalist government really requires something like war, which will induce them to simply say, save us. We'll give up whatever liberty is necessary to save us, just as we've done in 9/11, which was a minor test case, so to speak.
Well, of course, this is what happened in Europe after the First World War. After the horror of that terrible war, people were willing to give up their national sovereignty in Europe and join the League of Nations. And then when that failed, well, we had to have a Second World War, and that was to bring about the United Nations. But America had never seen the ravages of war, at least not those that they'd seen in Europe. This is why, of course, some people in Europe are willing to go along with the European Union. The older people, many of the younger people, of course, don't want it. But they're going to have to do something horrible. I agree with you. I think we are creating the best enemies money could buy in preparation for creating World War III. And I fear for this country when that comes about, because I'm not sure the American people, the majority of them, still have the moral integrity or fiber to stand up in times of terrible suffering and turmoil.
Well, you know, suffering and turmoil will bring out the best in some. It also brings out the worst in a great many others, and that's the problem with war. But worst of all, you know, we are going to be faced with a war where, for the first time, in my opinion, the U.S. itself is going to be struck in a giant preemptive strike. I think that's what all of this antagonism is about. Russia and China are the real axis of evil. In order for them to justify attacking the United States preemptively, the U.S. has to hand them the excuse by appearing as the bully of the world, intervening in country after country, antagonizing first all the Slavic people in the Balkans, and then, which spilled over into Russia and the other Slavic countries. They have a great deal of disrespect for the U.S. over what happened to their fellow compatriots there in the Balkan areas. And now we have the United States out antagonizing the entire Arab world, and these two major population groups constitute one of the major potential sources of support for Russia and China, and by antagonizing and making them anti-Western and anti-U.S., there's a lot in the world that's going to cheer when Russia finally has the excuse to provoke attacking the United States. And frankly, Americans are going to be shocked. They simply are not prepared. The evidence is before them, but in very, very small sources. It's very much suppressed. And that's one of the things that disturbs me, is that U.S. intelligence know that Russia's preparing for war. They know that China's preparing for war against the West, and not just over the issue of Taiwan. Taiwan will simply be a trigger issue. What they're really, the U.S. intelligence really knows that these people are preparing to nuke the United States. They eavesdrop on their conversations, their military exercises. They know they begin each exercise with a simulated preemptive strike, a nuclear strike on America. They know it's going
to
come.
And how could we object to a preemptive strike? After all, we've established the right of a country to attack anybody they feel may be a threat to them.
You know, one of the most telling things, though, is that people that retire from government almost uniformly go out to retire in the Rocky Mountains, in these wealthy communities in Colorado, Estes Park, and otherwise, have hundreds of CIA agents and intelligence people from DIA that are building large, high-security bomb shelters in their cabins and their luxury homes. These people know that war is coming. This is one of the best-kept secrets in America. If these people who have kept the secret because their careers are on the line and they're told not to say anything about Russian war preparations, and if they're building bomb shelters and they're building ways to protect themselves, you know they know something.
I agree with you, and I think that every American should be very, very concerned about what's going on. And, of course, because of the degree of control of the media, the donut, we've antagonized Europe, many of the people, the majority of the people in Europe and the majority of the people in Great Britain today oppose the war and oppose what we're doing over in Iraq. And, of course, here in the United States, I'm still shocked to realize that almost 50% of the people, or maybe even a little over 50% of the people, still support this war, thinking that somehow they're supporting America.
Well, there's a tremendous propaganda line. I noticed that in the past 2 or 3 weeks, we have all of these yellow ribbon stickers appearing on cars. I mean, this takes a lot of money to finance some of these things, and there are some... This is not really a true groundswell. This is a huge corporate effort to extend and make use of patriotism and support our troops to give people a knee-jerk type of support for this war in Iraq. And I think the full intent is to get George Bush reelected. And even though you know, I don't want to see Kerry as president of the United States. It doesn't, to me, it isn't much of a difference whether you have George Bush or Kerry, except that George Bush, in fact, is more effective at getting the American people to go along with losses in their liberty than John Kerry would. Conservatives would certainly object to what Kerry would do if he were doing the same things that George Bush would do. But when George Bush does them, most conservatives go along.
Well, of course, if we had Kerry in, we might have gridlock in the Senate and House, and what we need is a little gridlock right now. And, of course, the other thing is, of course, our previous guest this evening had pointed out, if John Kerry is really trying to win the election, why doesn't he ask the question, what really happened on 9-1-1? Why did the Bush administration not take the measures necessary to defend America? And yet, John Kerry has never brought up that subject.
You know, one of the interesting things that's coming out as people begin to scrutinize the 9-11 Commission report, there was, for example, a transcript of the conversations between hijackers and the passengers who were supposedly trying to get through the cabin door to stop the hijackers. And they came out with a transcript that is totally different than anything that the family heard when the CIA and government supposedly let selected family members listen to the transcript of the yelling and screaming going on. And there were Arab translators telling them what they were saying, and it's totally different. So we have to come to the conclusion, where did this transcript come from that the 9-11 Commission surfaced? And the timing is completely off. In other words, the timing that's on this transcript doesn't match either the time that the plane supposedly crashed, it doesn't match the time that certain of those passengers made phone calls to their wives about going forward to the cabin. There's a whole mismatch between things. It shows that somebody has manufactured evidence for the 9-11 Commission.
And, of course, if they manufactured evidence, what else are they lying about? People only have to remember those two passports from two of the hijackers that survived the raging inferno, one in New York City, where nothing else survived but a passport, the other, of course, at the site in Pennsylvania, the crash site of Flight 93, and there were other things that survived, but how did that passport get out of the terrorist pocket and out of the airplane and survive the inferno? And it was a little singed, admittedly, but that is the most amazing coincidence. And if anybody believed that really happened the way we've been told, they must be incredibly naive.
And, of course, the 9-11 Commission took great pains to emphasize certain pieces of evidence that they either falsified or carefully construed to match the official point of view. But some of the greatest questions that cried out for answers, such as the large pools of molten metal in the bottom of the World Trade Center, why that could not have been explained by burning jet fuel or even debris burning, you know, there was no rehearsal of that information. There was no experts called to testify about what that meant in terms of thermite explosives meant to bring down the massive pillars that were holding up the structure. It's my estimation that that's what actually brought the World Trade Center down. Was the melting of those 42 central core pillars, especially since the second tower that was hit, which wasn't even hit except at the corner, collapsed, and it collapsed centrally. If you look at the pictures, you can see that the whole structure is collapsing around the center, and then it's pancaking down in a controlled fashion. And that's precisely what you would expect if you remove the central core, and then only you have small, flimsy metal elements that are keeping the rest of the building up.
I mean, in fact, I have seen some pictures where it looks like the top begins to tilt to one side, and then somehow it flips back up straight and comes down straight. Doesn't make sense if what we're being told is true. Well, our guest has been Joel Skousen this evening. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program. Remember, you'll want to go start your morning by going to your computer and typing in www.worldaffairsbrief.com. That's worldaffairsbrief.com. And if you don't subscribe to World Affairs Brief, well, you're missing out on some of the greatest information we have. We'll get to Roger in just a moment here before we end the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Roger's been patiently holding on the listening. Roger, you have a question for our guest.
Yeah, does this 9-1-1 Commission report sort of, by comparison, make the JFK Commission look, that at least looked
somewhat plausible right out of the box. Sometimes it took months or years till we found out how awful it was. But this 911 commission is like so full of the holes right out of the box.
All right, fine. What are your thoughts on the 911 commission, Joel?
Well, it's true. You know, they've actually gone to great extents to falsify information and leave huge holes. They've learned something, of course. The American public was much more trusting about the Warren Commission, and it really wasn't until people looked and read through those multiple volumes and started to see the contradictions which were openly in there. But they've gone to much greater lengths to falsify information, which shows collusion by the commission staff itself. I mean, they were in direct collusion with government.
Okay, fine. Thank you so much. Anything else you want to say, Roger?
Yeah, lastly, I wanted to ask your start of the show about the, I guess it's a pointless question, but I'll ask it anyway, and that would be to what constitutional allowance would the emergency powers be enabling legislation for?
All right, fine. So the emergency powers legislation, where is the constitutional basis for that?
There is none.
All right. I think that's so important to understand. The president has simply taken this power unto himself, and of course it could be limited by Congress, couldn't it? But they've just refused to do what they should do under the Constitution?
Well, and they authorized the emergency powers as well, and so that's the problem. But they were never constitutionally challenged. There is no constitutional authority for suspending the Constitution.
So I think that we've got a real problem in America, and the most important thing is for our citizens to learn the Constitution, to understand the Constitution. Joel's uncle, Joel Cleon Skousen, worked at this for 30 years ago. He was trying to teach people the Constitution. We've got to get back to doing the same thing. Joel, thank you so much for being with us again. We'll look forward to talking to you tomorrow.
All right, my pleasure.
Good night, and God bless you. Okay, fine. Well, that's been Joel Skousen of World Affairs Brief. I hope you've enjoyed the program, and as always, it's a pleasure to go over these things with Joel. He analyzes the material. His site, World Affairs Brief, is one of the best overall sources of information you'll find. And, of course, remember that there is, behind everything going on today, dark and sinister spirits of forces, intent upon destroying what was once the land of the free and the home of the brave, because at one time America was a Christian nation. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here wrapping up the evening. I hope you enjoyed our guest. I thought the first guest that was fascinating, Dr. Joel Skousen, pardon me, Joe Douglas. I always enjoy having Joe on. And of course, if you'd like to get a copy of that interview, why, you can give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then Joel, of course, is always stimulating. And I think you have to understand that we went to war with Iraq because we wanted to have a base in the Middle East so we could attack Iran and Syria. How can I say that? Well, I read the plan. It's all right there at the Project for the New American Century website and in the publication that they put out, Rebuilding America's Defenses. Now, if you want to get the keys to that, you need to get our Iraq, the Untold Story syllabus and video that goes with that. The video is the talk. Iraq, the Untold Story syllabus gives you the documentation for that, and it includes the material from the Project for the New American Century. What is the Project for the New American Century? Well, you can go to their website, newamericancentury.org. It was a group of 25 people who in 1997 put together an organization to create a new international order that would be favorable to our security, our protection, and our profits. And that was what they said. And then, of course, in 1998, they were calling for a war with Iraq. In 2000, they were writing to the president, calling for a war with Iraq. And who were these people? Donald Rumsfeld, Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, John Bolton, Undersecretary of State, Liddy, who is, of course, the Chief of Staff for Cheney, a man named Elliot Abrams, three or four others in key positions out of the original 25. How did they get their people into key positions in government? because there are dark forces working behind the scenes that have nothing to do. Our president doesn't pick his staff. It's picked by the people who truly rule America, America's secret government. And so you need to get our material, Iraq, the Untold Story. Get the documentation. Read what they're saying. Read the plan. It's all right there. The plan was we will have our forces permanently stationed in the Middle East, irrespective of whether Saddam Hussein remains in power or not. This will transcend the rights of Saddam Hussein. They talk with glowing terms about creating new genetic warfare agents so we can target specific races and kill them off with new diseases. These are evil and, in my estimation, wicked people. You need to read their master plan and understanding, of course, that this is going to bring a blowback. It's going to bring about World War III, in my estimation. Get the information, read my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness, and of course get our material on the secret government, the four tape set, or the secret government special, because there really are secret societies working behind the scenes, directing the affairs of mankind. For remember, we struggle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers of the rulers of the darkness of this world, against spirits of wickedness in high places. So, remember our meeting we're going to be holding here in the Monterey Bay area. That's going to be on November 6th, all day long, Saturday. We're bringing in outside speakers. Lunch is going to be served. Give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. It's time to make your reservation because we're going to need to know how many people are going to be there. Bring your friends. Talk others into coming. Even if they don't know there's a problem, get them there. And, well, we'll try to convince them of the degree of the problem that exists today. Of course, if we don't face this, if we don't reach the American people, if we don't turn our people back to God, unless we get them to understand what's happening in America and the spirits of forces working behind the scenes towards the New World Order, the New World Economy, the New World Currency, and the New World Religion. Unless the American people understand the nature of the enemy we face, why, the freedom we've known will soon become simply a remembrance of things past. Go to our website at RadioLiberty.com, RadioLiberty.com. Order our video, They Sold Their Souls for Rock and Roll. The 4-hour or the 10-hour version, it will help you to document to your own satisfaction the true spiritual nature of what we're up against. Pray for America, pray for revival. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection until tomorrow. At the same time, may the Lord be with you.